Right now, wind is calm, humidity 80%, sunshine 58 degrees. 10 past 8 for WGTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. We're going to be spending today's Morning Show talking about the recent events in Charlottesville, Virginia, through the perspective of two people who live there, who work there, and who experienced some of that fairly close. Although I don't mean to imply that that we're talking about people who were standing in front of statues or part of demonstrations or anything, but just people who live and work in Charlottesville, Virginia. Just to get a perspective of, let's say, an ordinary citizen who lives in the wake of these events. One of the people we're talking to is someone that I know well. She grew up in Racine, born and raised there. And her name in Racine, Crystal Clement. Her married name now, as she lives in Charlottesville, Virginia, Crystal Pariseau. And she very kindly agreed to answer a couple of questions about what unfolded 10 days ago. And the kind of things she, the ways in which she tried to talk about this with her own children, what people have been saying around town, neighbors and friends and so on, how they've been sort of trying to come to grips with these bewildering events that that unfolded there. Crystal Pariseau, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for agreeing to do this. I know it feels a little strange, and I also want to reiterate something that you said in your first response to me, is which is you do not feel comfortable speaking on behalf of the whole community of Charlottesville, Virginia, and I certainly respect that and understand that. I was really curious and interested to just find out from you sort of what it was like to live through these events as they unfolded. One of the first things I wanted to ask you is, going into what ultimately happened, how much did you, for instance, know about what was going to be happening? What kind of forewarning was there, for instance, that there was going to be this large demonstration on Friday night involving certainly white supremacists and neo-Nazis, among others? How much did anybody in Charlottesville know about this event being scheduled to occur?
Yeah, the Friday night one took me a lot by surprise. I think we all knew Saturday was happening. In fact, to go back even further than last week, there was an event in mid-July with a couple dozen white supremacist neo-Nazis that came into town and preceded this. And so we knew that it was going to be an event. The peace in July ended pretty badly. That was also scary. The police ended up using some military grade tear gas. I mean, it sort of escalated very, very quickly. So knowing that this was going to happen again, what we were seeing in the media from my friends on Facebook, I have several friends who do work in organizations like Black Lives Matter and Standing Up for Racial Justice, and who were more in tune with exactly what was happening and speaking with law enforcement and talking to city council people. And able to say with some honesty, this is going to be a very big deal. So going into it, I was extremely nervous, not knowing what was coming at us, not knowing what the city's response was going to be, not knowing what the counter-protest was going to be. I had a lot of apprehension about Saturday. Turning on the news, watching Twitter, and seeing Friday night these horrendous pictures of white supremacists and Nazis marching through the beautiful UVA campus towards students, towards UVA students with torches and chanting was absolutely terrifying. So that took me by surprise to the extent that we saw their numbers. All of a sudden, we saw the violence in their eyes. We saw what was happening in our town and on our street. It's very surreal to see something like that come to life on the streets where you walk, where you we trick-or-treat on the lawn with our kids. The lawn is part of the UVA campus on the gun. We call it grounds, where these students live and where the marchers ultimately came over the hill and came. You saw them stand right in front of the rotunda. We trick-or-treat there with our kids. We take pictures there. It's just it's a gorgeous, very historical place. And to see that come to life, not just on TV in somebody else's town, but in your own town, was this very surreal confluence of events that you can't believe it's happening in the first place, but to be happening here, to be happening in your own city was just, it was pretty overwhelming.
Right. In other words, this would be shocking wherever it was happening. I mean, it's sort of unbelievable to have Nazis marching down an American street or on an American college campus, let alone when those streets and that college campus are exactly where you live. It sounds like, for the most part, you spent Friday night sticking close to home.
Friday night we had sort of intention. We knew Saturday was happening. We knew it was going to be there were permits for Saturday afternoon. I had made the conscious decision that I was going to stay safe with my family. We sort of live in a suburb, somewhere about 5-10 minutes north of campus, north of town. Was going to stay up here with our family. We were actually holding a delayed birthday party for some of our kids and having some friends over and saying, you know, we're going to try and turn off the TV a little bit and try and stay out of this and do stay out of it is the wrong word, but not be downtown and not put ourselves right in harm's way, which is a loaded, it's a loaded sentiment for me, and I think for a lot of people around town, to know that we have the privilege of making that choice to stay out of these events sometimes when it's convenient, when it's easier, when it's safer, and there are a lot of people around the country that don't have that choice, that live it every day, whether they are in their home or in their own town or you know, anywhere else. I think there's a lot of guilt that comes with that and a lot of feelings and a lot of heavy emotions. But Friday and Saturday, we stayed here. So not being down on the downtown mall in the city, we weren't, I did not go and stand in front of the statue. I did not go to stand in the streets because, like I said, knowing from a couple weeks ago how bad it got, I just had an awful feeling about it. Mm. We saw folks. We saw the demonstrators. We saw the Nazis. We saw the white supremacists. I had friends texting me across the street at the grocery store pictures of folks piling out of cars with machine guns and shields. Standing there waiting for carpools and buses to take them downtown. I had a friend come to our house and say, we just passed about 100 guys that looks like a motorcycle gang. They have Confederate flags hanging out the back of their motorcycles, and they're driving towards town. So it was all very close, even if we were not on the streets where they were marching. It was still in the air, and you know, just in every sort of feeling and conversation and look that we all had between all the adults. You know, we all were checking our phones and kind of taking stock of what was going on. I kept thinking, even Friday night when I was seeing some of the images come down, trying to take take stock of who my friends are downtown, and do I need to, who can I call and offer them to come stay at my house? You know, do they need to get out of their house? Do they need to come to the north side, to the suburbs, to feel safe? Do I need to offer that as a sanctuary to anybody? And how can that play out? How can I help without literally standing in front of, well, what it turned out, literally standing in front of guns.
Mm. Can you say a word about what, if anything, you have said to your own children, some of whom are, I know, are quite young, or by and large, has this at least largely passed by them or passed over them?
Yeah.
So they are essentially unaware of the events that, that took place in your town.
Yeah, I have four kids, two in preschool, one going into first grade, and one going into third grade. And we didn't say anything to them on Friday and Saturday, not knowing the full story, the full ramifications. I just kind of wanted to give them a little bit of time, give myself a little bit of time to understand and to process. I think even 2 weeks out, we're still all processing this, and it's going to be a really long time before the adults, let alone the kids, kind of figure out where we go from here as a city and as a family and as individual people, and how this kind of changes our worldview in some ways for the better, in some ways for the worse. So on Sunday morning, I sat down with the kids on the way to church, because I knew we'd be talking about it at church, and the older kids, the two older ones. And just said, you know, this is going to be a hard service. There were some people in town yesterday who don't necessarily agree with the same things that we agree with. They think that people with different color skin don't necessarily have the same rights as we do, and tried to talk about it in very general terms. Not get into the nitty-gritty, talk about, you know, they had questions. Well, what does that mean, that people with different, well, think of your friends, and this, and maybe that some of these people believe that your friends should not be able to play with you or go to school at the same schools, or that they, you know, should be somewhere else. And both of them got that very clearly when they said, wait, you mean they think that I shouldn't be able to play with so-and-so, or that my friend shouldn't be able to be on the same basketball team as I am? You know, well, why not? He's just as good as me at this, and he's better than me at these skills. And, you know, so that was a good conversation. Tried to keep it relatively short, knowing that they can't process too much at once. And we've returned to it several times. They catch bits of it on the news as you're flipping by, or, you know, as my cell phone is face up instead of face down, they see a notification or something pop up, or hear somebody talk about it. And I think going into school, our school starts today, actually. So they're going to probably be hearing more about it from some friends. I know some people are sharing a lot with their kids, and some are sharing nothing with their kids. So I'm trying to use some books and friends and resources to help them process and understand what white supremacy means, and why it's a problem for our family and for our society, and how they can stand against it and stand up for their friends when they see something going on that that doesn't signify equality and inclusion.
Right. In a sense, you were facing some of the same issues that, for instance, your mom faced on 9/11. I don't have any idea how old you were on 9/11, if you were a young girl or a little older, but certainly parents and teachers and so on really grappled on that day with what to say and how to say it, or whether or not to say anything at all. Those are not easy choices to make.
You're absolutely right. I went downtown with a group of friends the other night to the follow-up vigil, I guess we're calling it, to downtown on grounds. There was a candlelight vigil where it was a sort of take back the march, take back the streets that the Nazis walked on with candles and songs and love. And the kids, I had to leave before bedtime. So the kids, where are you going, Mom? Why aren't you here? And so trying to explain to them, remember when something awful happened and somebody died, and, you know, it's time to, I need to pray about it with people and stand up for what's right and make sure that we are present to say these things are wrong. They got that. They really understood the importance of standing up for what's right. Mm. I was proud of them.
Yeah, I'm sure you are, with good reason. How would you describe Charlottesville, Virginia itself and this ugliness that was seen? How much of that was, in a sense, from outside? Mm-hmm.
Charlottesville is, it's complicated. it's beautiful. It's a small town, really it is. It's a collegiate town loaded with history and tradition, and it's beautiful. It's Thomas Jefferson's university and city. It's somewhat remote in that, you know, Richmond is about an hour and a half away. D.C. is about 2 hours away. Other smaller towns are still about an hour away. We're kind of in this little bubble next to the mountains. It really is just a beautiful place. My corner of Charlottesville, I'll say, is relatively well-educated, liberal. But Charlottesville, once you look a little bit deeper, does have its divides. There is a lot of sort of covert racism when you really get under it that I think people are recognizing a lot more strongly in the recent weeks. There are lines between, as with any city, between haves and have-nots. There's a lot of very old families, old money, well-to-do farms, and just gorgeous places. But there's a lot of smaller places as well that that don't have access to some of the resources as other parts of the city. It's very easy to be here and get sort of swept up in the tradition and beauty of UVA, and it's we generally really love living here. People are largely kind and sweet and welcoming, but I think the past couple weeks is everybody's just more aware, and everybody's more having more conversations about what things really mean, and I think that's a good thing.
Right.
There's still a lot of very high emotions, and I think it's going to be that way for quite a while.
Yeah, the absolutely.
That's
great. We're kind of talking about the well-known phenomenon of town and gown, that that in many communities where there is an institution of higher learning, there is the one facet of the community that is gown for the college or university, and then there is the town, and sometimes that there can be a very, very sharp line of delineation. I've seen that in all kinds of different places, and it sounds like Charlottesville is no exception.
That was the other half you asked about the inside versus outside of the city. My apologies. I had conversations on Saturday even with some folks who were talking with other friends, getting texts. There's a lot of sort of concern and fear that folks outside of Charlottesville, folks from just watching the national news and seeing hashtag Charlottesville, this happened in Charlottesville, Charlottesville is. While Charlottesville has its problems, like most any city, it has divides, it has challenges, I would, I can't put an actual number on it, but I would take a wild guess that the vast majority of folks who were doing the white supremacists, the Nazis, were from out of town. You know, we saw video, we saw license plates of folks who were coming from other states to be here. So, you know, I was talking with friends and students at UVA are coming back right now too, and you know, I think there's a lot of people that are nervous, saying, "Wait a minute, I don't want to move here anymore." Or is this city a city full of Nazis? And in no way is that true. It's a very liberal city. Although, like you said, the phenomenon, when you look at some of the election results and some of the actual numbers, there's a large chunk of people who voted maybe in a not so liberal context. So, but I would not classify this city as by any means as a white supremacist city. I think the folks who showed up for the vigil the other night, the folks who were doing a lot of the counter protesting, not all of it, those were the Charlottesville people, as opposed to the folks who are coming in to say, we need to keep this monument and we need to trample on the rights of folks who don't have the same color skin as we do.
It's going to be interesting to see where this goes from here. But in the meantime, I so appreciate you sharing your really thoughtful perspective on what it was like to experience this sort of up close. And I imagine, to some extent at least, you're hungry for the day when you can meet a friend in the grocery store aisle and not be talking about this, but talking about the weather and talking about basketball or whatever. But
We want to get back to talking about the good stuff. We want to be able to, you know, we sent our babysitter off to college and said, you know, when you say you're from Charlottesville, say it proudly and tell them the good stuff. You know, we hope that folks don't start thinking of Charlottesville as just this. We don't want this to identify us, but at the same time, there are really great opportunities here for conversation, for change. Some of it's going to take a really long time, but I'm proud of our city for standing up, for starting some of these movements, and I hope that it continues in what I see as a very positive direction from here.
Crystal Pariseau, born and raised in Racine and now a proud, grateful resident of Charlottesville, Virginia. Crystal, thank you so much for making time for this conversation.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And now we're going to continue our conversation with someone else who lives and works in Charlottesville, Virginia. This is Pastor Lauren Miller. She happens to be the pastor of Crystal Pariseau's church, Peace Lutheran Church in Charlottesville. And, of course, one thinks about a church bearing that name in maybe a little different light, given the events that unfolded in Charlottesville about 10 days ago. And I appreciate Pastor Miller joining me to talk about what she saw and experienced as these events unfolded, and also what her response to it has been in the wake of these events. She as an individual and also the congregation which she serves as pastor. Pastor Lauren Miller, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you making time for this. Not that anybody wants to relive something as awful as what occurred in Charlottesville, but I'm afraid that's kind of the first question that I have. I would really like you to describe, in a sense, where you were and how you experienced what occurred in Charlottesville last Friday and Saturday. And maybe coupled with that question, how much did you know ahead of those events what was going to happen. What kind of forewarning was there about what was going to be happening that weekend?
Sure. Well, really, it backs up to last month when the KKK showed up in Charlottesville. They bussed in from North Carolina. It was a small group. But the city and the community, I think, organized a fantastic response to that. There were, of course, the counter-protesters who were present there in the park with the KKK, and then there were community potluck picnics, and there was a free concert, and NAACP had an event with speakers. There were so many things for the community to do that day, and the community really came out in force to say, you know, this is not who we are. We are not about hate in this city. And we knew the day of that event that the permit had already been requested for this past weekend. And so it seemed like, it felt like at the time, this is a bit of a trial run. We were hearing that more people were expected for this rally this past weekend. So the clergy community began to organize. There is a clergy collective that had already been meeting to talk about issues of race, and so relationships were being built already before any of this came about. And then out of that, there was a group that put together a separate but related response called Congregate Seville, where they put out a call to have 1,000 clergy come to be present and be a witness for peace in our city. So I was honored to be with a number of clergy, Lutheran clergy from around the state who came in for the 2 days, including our bishop and a number of pastors. And that's just from the ELCA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. There were clergy from any and every denomination you can think of. It was very much an interfaith event. There were Jewish leaders there. And so we gathered on Friday night for a worship service at an Episcopal church adjacent to UVA. And it was an incredible experience. Cornel West was there and spoke very powerfully. Reverend Tracy Blackman was there, spoke incredibly powerfully. We were singing. We were praying. There was just an incredible atmosphere of hope and peace and energy of moving forward together as a community, knowing that hate was not going to define us. And as worship was wrapping up, we received word, they announced to the assembled group, which was, I'm not sure the exact number, but I think it was somewhere in the mid-600s. So there were hundreds of people there, not just clergy, but people of faith.
Wow.
And so we were packed. It was a packed house, and we received the announcement that it was not safe for us to leave, that there were folks with torches heading down the street right in front of the church. So the atmosphere quickly became a lot more tense, just the uncertainty of not knowing what was happening outside and whether we were safe where we were. You know, it freaked some folks out, certainly. And so we sat back down in the pews and waited and talked and prayed and sang. And a few minutes later, they told us that it was safe to go out the side door to make sure we exited in groups. And they had folks at the door checking in with us as we were leaving to make sure we knew how to get safely back to our car. I was with a couple of other clergy, some of whom had parked on the other side of UVA, and so we drove over there so they didn't have to walk through. And of course, at that time, the folks with torches had moved past the church and onto UVA grounds and were surrounding the Jefferson statue at that point. As we exited the building, we could see them in the distance. We could hear them chanting. They were shouting blood and soil. They were shouting You will not replace us, and then Jews will not replace us. It was a sickening sight. It was hard to believe that this is 2017. I felt like I had stepped into another era, that this could possibly be happening right in front of us was tragic. So we, as far as I know, everyone did make it back safely to their vehicles, but it was a very intimidating experience that night. And so we knew if that was what was already happening the night before, that the next day was going to be pretty intense. So we gathered again Saturday morning. There was a sunrise service at 6 a.m. and then another gathering at 8 a.m. where, and I was present for the 8 a.m. gathering, which was hundreds of clergy who marched through the city to a park near where the white supremacists were going to be gathering later that day. And there we, again, sang. We listened to some speakers who were incredibly powerful, calling us to really bear witness to justice and peace. And at that point, there were some clergy who were gathering to do more direct action. The clergy collective was very clear that they didn't want folks who had not been trained in nonviolent resistance to be involved in that way, which was a good thing and a smart thing. We really wanted everyone to stay safe. So there was a group of clergy who, you know, they're the ones that we've seen in the media, the powerful image of them walking arm in arm, being present bodily as a witness for peace and love in the face of hate. And then there were many, many others who went to a Methodist church that's adjacent to Emancipation Park and were present there for just helping anyone who needed help, whether that was prayer, whether that was medics, whether that was someone to talk to and process all of this. And those clergy were there throughout the day and then also spread out into the city and were present as a presence of God's love in the midst of an awful situation.
It sounds like the response was vigorous. How planned was the response? I mean, how, in a sense, planned and coordinated was it?
Right. I was impressed with how quickly both the clergy locally and then clergy nationally responded once we realized how serious a threat this was, and how important and vital it absolutely was for us to stand up and say, no, this is not okay. We are not going to tolerate hate. We're not going to tolerate racism in our city. And so I was not one of the main planners, so I can't speak to all of that, but I do know that those who were leading were incredible in the months leading up to this event in sending out emails and communicating with us about what the plans were. There was a whole week of events leading up to it. Every night there were prayer services, there were educational events. I attended a fantastic little workshop on Thursday night, the night before, on the history of race and ethnicity in Charlottesville that really opened my eyes to things that I didn't know about the city. And again, that was a completely packed house, lots of folks there wanting to learn and wanting to understand the issues, which was really a great thing to see happening as well. So it wasn't just a response on Saturday that was planned. It was really a whole week of equipping and prayerfully anticipating what was going to be happening over the weekend, And now, moving forward, we can't just leave it there. It can't just be what happened last weekend. Our work has just begun in working to dismantle white privilege and helping to have these caring conversations, these tough conversations as a community about things that have so deeply divided us.
And my understanding is that one facet of the this statue of Robert E. Lee and other statues in Charlottesville is tied to who gave these statues in the first place and the parks in which they were placed. Tell us just a little bit about that.
Yes, yeah, the parks were created in the 20s by a rich gentleman who gifted the land to the city. And there were five parks, four of which were given to be white parks, and then one park that would be the black park. And that, of course, was the park that was built on land that wasn't really good for much of anything. And they said, well, we'll make that a park for the African-American community. So these statues of Lee and Jackson were placed in the white parks. And my understanding, I would want to clarify this with a historian who knows more than me, but my understanding is that this man who gave the statues or that gave the parks were really doing that to honor his mother. So it wasn't that he thought Lee was so fantastic he wanted his own park for Lee. It was he wanted to honor his mom by using his wealth to create these public places in Charlottesville, and they picked some folks who were in the 1920s were considered heroes among the white population in the South.
Wow. And so, for instance, this statue of Robert E. Lee, about which so much controversy now swirls, was built in a park that, when it opened, was for white people only.
Correct.
Wow. I'm speaking to Pastor Lauren Miller. She is pastor at Peace Lutheran Church in Charlottesville, Virginia. And we are, of course, talking about the events that unfolded in Charlottesville about 10 days ago now and their aftermath. Pastor Miller, can you just say a quick word about how a pastor prepares for Sunday morning worship when horrific events have just occurred down the street, the 2 days before? I just wonder the kind of things that went through your mind in terms of trying to think about what to say and how to say it.
Yeah. Well, first of all, a whole lot of prayer, a whole lot of time in scripture, and a whole lot of time in conversation with others who were engaged in this work. You know, I had to do my own processing. I still do, and do my own self-check of where I am, just as a white person. I have my own things I need to wrestle with in terms of the ways that I have not been a voice for racial justice as much as I really should be. So a lot of that was doing self-reflection, talking with other people in the community, but most of all, just time in prayer, time in the Word. I spent a long time on Saturday afternoon and evening, really prayerfully considering the words that needed to be said on Sunday morning. And I knew that it needed to be a message both of hope and peace and grace, and also a word of challenge. And I think that's the wonderful thing about our God, is that God gives us all of that, that we can respond to the grace that God gives us through the ways that we interact in the community. So I spoke a lot about love and the ways that God shows up in unexpected places. And I spoke, too, about part of our journey now is to look at ourselves and be able to name the places we have not stood up for our neighbors in the ways that we really need to moving forward. Hmm.
Of course, part of what this was all about was a statue of Robert E. Lee. Can you just say a quick word about the way in which the community of Charlottesville has wrestled with this reality, this statue of Robert E. Lee, and the question of whether or not this statue still has a place in a public place? What kind of conversations have gone on about this, and what kind of conversations are likely to occur from this point on?
The conversation about the statues has been going on for a couple of years. As to whether they really have a place in our city as something that we want to lift up and honor. Earlier this year, there was actually a high school student who petitioned the city council to remove the statue. And that impetus, along with a couple of folks on city council, really brought the issue into the forefront and I think pushed there to be a decision made. So I believe it was February that the city council voted to remove the statue. There was then a lawsuit, and so things were put on hold in March. And that, I think, really opened up Charlottesville to be a flashpoint for all of the racial tension in our country. It attracted the attention of a lot of people, obviously, this issue about the statue. And many conversations, I mean, everybody in Charlottesville has an opinion about the statue. Many conversations have been had. I think, though, what this weekend was about wasn't really about the statue at all. That sort of, again, provided the flashpoint, the centering moment. But what happened here this weekend was so much bigger than any statue. It really, I think, revealed to us as a city and as a country the amount of hate that's sort of been bubbling under the surface, that's just sort of been peeled back and exposed for everyone to see. And so I hope that moving forward, we don't get stuck on a statue, but really can talk about what's underlying that. What are the fears that people have that are, I think, driving? I think a lot of fear is driving conversation right now. What are the concerns that people have about what do they think they'll be losing by that statue not being there? To help people really walk in other people's shoes and understand what that statue represents to people of color in our community, I think it's going to be important. But we have to get past the statue and look at the broader issues of intolerance and hate and the ways in which a lot of our leadership right now in our country is allowing this sort of rhetoric to continue.
I read an interesting article on the New Yorker website, which actually focused on the group of clergy that you mentioned, the Charlottesville Clergy Collective, and it was very intriguing to read a little bit about how this group of clergy came together, and also to read a little bit about some of the really complex questions which you are having to confront about, for instance, what do we do now, and how do we frame this this national conversation on whatever level it occurs? How do we frame that conversation in such a way that it's ultimately the most beneficial and constructive? Can you just say a word about what your experience has been as part of the Charlottesville Clergy Collective in terms of wrestling with some of these questions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my primary engagement has been through sort of a spinoff of that, which has been a women's clergy circle. And we've been meeting for about a year now, and it's all women in leadership, in religious leadership in one way or another in the city of Charlottesville. And we've been primarily meeting over lunch to talk about differences, to talk about how to talk to one another, to build relationship among each other who are all coming from very different walks of life, very different colors of skin, very different religious traditions. And so that's been going on for a long time before the summer happened. And those relationships have been so crucial to me in facing some of these issues, because how can I speak to issues of difference if I don't have people who are different than me in my life and having significant relationships with them and hearing their stories and knowing each other in that way? So, yeah, I think a lot of the clergy in Charlottesville are realizing that we really need to be there for each other, support each other, and wrestle together with these tough questions. We can't ask our congregations to wrestle with tough questions if we're not willing to do it among ourselves. And so having the opportunity to do that has really been invaluable to me, to opening my eyes to others' experiences and the ways in which a lot of these events are perceived. We see these all differently, and what a gift it's been to be able to hear those different voices as we move forward in the community.
Right. How much of the ugliness that was seen in Charlottesville was the result of outsiders entering your community versus some of these attitudes that reside there with some of the people who live there? I'm sure that's a difficult question to answer, but what is your sense of that? What sort of presence of hatred is there, and how does one best confront that?
Right. Well, like you said, it's hard for me to give a broad generalization, but my perception is that the majority of the folks who were coming for the white supremacist rally were coming from out of town. And my perception is that a very large number of the counter-protesters who were there to proclaim messages of peace and love were there from in town. Again, that's my unscientific view of the day, but it sure seemed like, the woman, Heather Heyer, who died, she was vocal and she was peacefully protesting. She was walking down the street when she got just brutally murdered by the car that hit her, who was driven by someone outside of Charlottesville. I think that a part of why Charlottesville became a target is because we did vote to remove those statues, because we did say, we're going to tell a different narrative. It's not about denying the history of white folks in our country. It's about recognizing that we've told a very limited story about who we are as a people, and that it's time to tell a broader story, a much broader story.
Pastor Lauren Miller is the pastor of Peace Lutheran Church in Charlottesville, Virginia. I deeply appreciate her making time in her schedule to join me for this morning show conversation. And my thanks as well to Crystal Clement Pariseau, again, a friend of mine from Racine who grew up there, who not only spoke with me for part one of today's morning show, but also put me in touch with Pastor Miller and helped broker that conversation. My deep thanks and appreciation to both of them. Tomorrow on the morning show, I look forward to the monthly visit of Nan Calvert. And she's going to be having with her a farmer from here in southeastern Wisconsin who specializes in the growing of heirloom wheat. We hear a lot about how the new wheat